I'm Paul Wright. I'm the founder and the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, and I'm also the editor of Prison Legal News, a magazine which I founded in 1990 while I was imprisoned in Washington State. I was a voracious reader, probably from around the time I was probably in around 7th or 8th grade until I got out of prison in 2003. I probably read anywhere between 3 and 5 books a week. And even as a young child, I mean, I remember reading. My parents were readers as well, so there was always books in the house, which I think, you know, kind of influences things. While I was in prison, I mean, I was still reading fiction, but, you know, I was really interested in Latin American fiction, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Julio Cortazar, Luis Borges, you know, that whole line of Latin writers. You know, pretty much as I was going through my prison sentence, you know, I got interested in the history of prisoners' rights. I also became interested in Marxism and communism. So my earliest lawsuits were around the censorship of Marxist-Leninist literature, and I'm litigating these cases pro se. And I've got a very skeptical judge in Spokane telling the attorney general, you know what, the United States won the Cold War. Who cares if Mr. Wright is reading books by Lenin in his maximum security prison cell? And, you know, 100-year-old books. And, you know, and there's hemming and hawing by the attorney general. Ultimately, I won the case. And I think that's kind of the differences of the judiciary. And winning the case also kind of encouraged me to do more litigation when stuff was censored. I challenged the censorship of main currents of Marxism, from Rousseau to Lenin. I brought successful suits around that, around the censorship of Mim Notes, the newsletter of the Maoist Internationalist Movement. So, yeah, I'm the guy who challenged a ban on sexually explicit material when they decided to ban all that. So, yeah, no, this is how I got good at this stuff. You know, I didn't just sit down and read a bunch of books on the First Amendment and First Amendment litigation. No, I got good at it litigating these cases. And I was litigating these cases successfully, pro se, representing myself. I wound up in prison because I was poor. And I was in the military at the time, and I was convicted of killing a drug dealer during an armed robbery. And I was arrested, charged with felony murder, and convicted all within around 5.5 months. So I entered the prison system. I was sentenced to 25 years and 4 months in prison around a week before my 22nd birthday. So on a 304-month sentence, I wound up doing around 17 years of it. The other thing, too, that really helped me intellectually when I was in prison was all the many publications that offered free subscriptions to prisoners. I mean, I was getting probably around 150, 200 different magazines from around the world, pretty much a whole variety of subjects. And I mean, I'm sad to say is that I was actually better informed about foreign affairs and foreign events when I was in prison than I am now, because now I don't have time to read what's going on in the Middle East or Southeast Asia or whatever was in prison. You know, I did. So that's kind of one of those paradoxes. And reading has just been a big part of my identity, a big part of who I am for pretty much almost as far back as I can remember. I mean, it's only been since I got out of prison that I stopped reading books the way I used to. But I hear I'm not the only person whose reading habits have changed with the internet. What basically gave me kind of the impetus to start Prison Legal News was basically frustration with the corporate media. It was one of those things where at the time, you know, the whole tough on crime thing was just getting started. And later, of course, it would intensify beyond much more than anything I had ever actually expected. And the people who were most impacted by this were prisoners and their families. Yet conversely, we were the ones that had the least amount of voice or say in any of what was going on or passing. And so that was one of the things where I thought it was important that prisoners have a say in what was going on. And I also saw the thing, too, was when we started Prison Legal News, our goal was just focus on Washington State, because I won't say every state had its own publication, but most states did. Most states had some type of publication that was being published that was, you know, reporting on what was happening in prisons or the criminal justice system. So we started publishing in 1990. We met a fair amount of hostility from prison officials, which we kind of expected. They kind of ignored us for a while. And so we kept publishing and we're slowly growing. And then kind of what happened was for the first couple of years, we didn't want to expand too much because we knew we had a limited capacity to be able to do that. So starting around the mid-90s, around 94 or so, that's when we really started to grow. As the publications in other states stopped publishing, we started picking up more subscribers in other states. And initially, it was kind of like, okay, wow, now we've got more subscribers in California than we do in Washington. Now we have more subscribers in California and Illinois than we do in Washington. So as we got more and more subscribers, the magazine grew both in size and content. We started adding writers, and we'd grown substantially. And we'd also gotten to the point where we had subscribers in all 50 states, and we were reporting news from all 50 states. And of course, in the meantime, by the end of the decade, after 10 years of publishing, what had started out at the beginning of the decade with around 50 or 55 publications around the country reporting on prisoner rights, I think by 2000, we're down to like two or three. I think it was state repression that extinguished those 50 other publications. You know, I mean, we can have the discussion of, you know, what's kind of killed print media in this country. You know, was it Google? Was it Facebook? Was it Craigslist? You know, was it readers shifting tastes and attention spans and whatnot? But, you know, I think we can have different analysis of why that happened. And besides that, you know, we started the decade with hundreds of prison publications being published by prisons around the country. And yes, they were censored and controlled by the warden's office, but, you know, but there was still something. And then by the end of the 90s, we're down to maybe one or two dozen of those. So it's kind of like literally the evisceration of the prison media. And this is all pre-internet. I think a lot about the restrictions that we've seen on free speech rights outside of prison as well. And that's why I say I think the prisons are all just a microcosm of society at large. I mean, if you look at all the different ways in which speech has been curtailed, restricted, and the levels of surveillance and state control over speech that we're subjected to as Americans now, I mean, even 20, 25 years ago, that wasn't even imagined. And if it was, people would have thought it was something out of a George Orwell or an Aldous Huxley novel. So that's why I say I think in a lot of respects, we've seen and are seeing the normalization of, I think, speech restriction and not just speech restriction. I think, you know, just everything that has to do with either dissent or anything that's critical of the American police state in ways that 20, 25 years ago weren't even thought of and that just seem to be accelerating and intensifying. As PLN started facing more censorship, then, you know, we started filing suits over the censorship of our publications. And I have to say is I don't think there's a publication anywhere in the country that is as dependent on lawyers for our readers to be able to read our publication. And frankly, you know, we wouldn't exist if it weren't for the many lawyers and firms over the years that have volunteered their time and helped us challenge this stuff in court and that have helped us get to the point where, you know, we're able to actually reach our readers. And, you know, we've pretty much faced, you know, 32 years of unrelenting hostility and censorship attempts by prison and jail officials across the country. Our litigation machine runs around $600,000 or $700,000 a year. And we're really doing it on the cheap. I mean, we don't have the capacity to do all the stuff we want to do. You know, we're limited in the censorship cases we can bring just because we just don't have enough lawyers to do it. And that said, we're able to get a huge amount of bang for the buck because we're really good at leveraging our resources. And we partner with other firms, we partner with other groups. We've got probably around 40 lawyers around the country working on censorship and First Amendment issues. You know, I've had people say, you know, well, you know, Paul, HRDC, you guys employ lawyers, and the bulk of the litigation that you do is around First Amendment and censorship. And why is that? Why don't you do other stuff? And it's like, well, because there's other pressing issues, you know, very pressing issues, conditions of confinement, inadequate medical care, excessive force, brutality. I mean, there's plenty of things that our legal team could be doing. But the reality is that no one's really coming to help prisoners en masse in this country. And that's been kind of our goal from the beginning, has been to give prisoners the information they need to be able to basically advocate for themselves, whether it's in court or otherwise, and be able to do something for themselves. Because otherwise, if they can't do it, no other help is coming. I mean, we also look at the impact that we have, both our magazines, our books, and everything else. And they do have an impact. They do change people's lives. And that's been kind of our driving force for over three decades now. But I also think that's also part of the reason why we face such unrelenting hostility from prison and jail officials, you know, that they really don't like the idea of people in captivity knowing that they have rights, being able to either speak about them or much less, you know, assert them. Or despite all its shortcomings, the reality is that the federal court system is really the closest thing to a check or an oversight that we really have in this country around prisoner jail issues. And for better or for worse, that's largely the only game in town.